From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jackson Pollock's dripped and poured paintings made him one of the most important and controversial artists of the century. Ed Harris directed and stars in a new movie about the artist called Pollock. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Kirk Varnadoe, who curated a major retrospective of Pollock's work at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Also, we listen back to a 1987 interview with actor Werner Klemperer, who died last week. He played Colonel Klink on Hogan's Heroes and was the son of the conductor Otto Klemperer. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews The Emperor's New Groove, a Disney animation featuring the voices of David Spade, Eartha Kitt, and John Goodman. It's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bush says he'll announce his first cabinet choice tomorrow. The appointment is expected to go to retired General Colin Powell as Secretary of State. Bush told reporters today that he's excited about getting to work in Washington. He says he'll make his case for the 10-year, $1.3 trillion tax cut that he promoted during his election campaign. House Speaker Dennis Hastert has said the proposal is too big and that Congress should concentrate on passing smaller measures. Members of Congress have wrapped up their lame duck session. A final agreement on a massive spending bill was reached after one key senator dropped his objections. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Republican Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, the powerful chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, single-handedly kept lawmakers from adjourning by objecting to administration limits on his state's pollock fishing industry. The dispute was resolved when the administration agreed to ease the limits somewhat and to go along with $30 million in assistance to the fishing industry. That paved the way for consideration of a massive spending package, the heart of which is a $350 billion measure funding a variety of health and education programs. There are also tax cuts for low-income communities in the bill, as well as $37 billion to restore cuts made to Medicare and Medicaid providers. Lawmakers are bringing home some goodies for the holidays, too, in the way of $850 million in programs for their home districts. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Attorney General Janet Reno has allowed the release of a former university professor who was jailed in Florida for more than 3 years on secret government evidence. An immigration judge ordered the man to be freed earlier this week. Reno temporarily blocked the release while she reviewed the case. NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
Mazen Al-Najjar is a Palestinian who was teaching Arabic at the University of Florida when the Immigration and Naturalization Service ordered that he be jailed. The INS says Al-Najjar had links to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which considers itself engaged in armed struggle against Israel. Najjar has denied any connection to terrorist groups. Neither he nor his lawyer was able to learn the specific evidence against him. The government claimed that to do so would breach national security. Secret evidence laws in place since the 1950s were strengthened in a 1996 anti-terrorism law, and the INS has used them in a number of cases involving Muslims in America. Last week, an immigration judge ruled Najjar hadn't been given a fair chance to defend himself. Libby Lewis, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 240 points, or 2.25%. It closed at 10,435 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 75 points, or 2.8%, to close at 2,653. The S&P 500 lost 28 points. This is NPR News. The nation's last contested congressional race ended today in Michigan. Democrat Diane Byrum conceded the race for House of Representatives to Mike Rogers, a Republican in the state Senate. Byrum asked for a recount after election results showed that Rogers had beaten her by just 160 votes out of about 300,000 cast. After the recount, the gap was smaller. Byrum conceded that Rogers had won by just 88 votes. Rogers' victory means that the Republicans have a 10-vote majority in the House. Government health officials say a listeriosis outbreak blamed for 4 deaths appears linked to turkey meat sold in delicatessens. Bill Catlin reports from Minnesota Public Radio.
Cargill Turkey Products is voluntarily recalling almost 17 million pounds of ready-to-eat turkey and chicken products produced at a facility in Waco, Texas, because of possible listeria contamination. Tom Skinner with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the same strain of the bacterium has shown up in 28 cases of listeriosis, including 4 deaths and 3 miscarriages.
The data that we have to date strongly suggest that deli turkey meat is the most likely cause of this outbreak.
Skinner says cases have been reported in 10 states, including California and New York. Listeriosis mainly threatens pregnant women, newborns, and adults with weakened immune systems. For NPR News, I'm Bill Catlin in St. Paul.
High winds and snow blasted the Pacific Northwest this morning. Winds gusting to 90 miles an hour knocked out power to about 200,000 people in Oregon and Washington. Another 100,000 people lost electricity around Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and Amgen, advancing the frontiers of medicine and improving the lives of patients through biotechnology.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ed Harris directed and stars in a new movie about Jackson Pollock. Pollock's dripped and poured paintings of the late 40s and the 50s shook up the art world, changed the direction of modern art, and made him one of the most important and controversial artists of the century. We're going to discuss Pollock's life and work with Kirk Varnado. 2 years ago, he co-curated a Pollock retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. New York Times art critic Michael Kimmelman wrote, "If you care about art, you live for exhibitions like this, in which an artist, against the heavy odds of his own skewed talent and unhinged personality, pursued something so wild, untested, and mysterious that its full meaning was unclear even to him." Here's a scene from Ed Harris's film, after Pollock has told his wife, the artist Lee Krasner, that he wants to have a baby. Krasner is played by Marcia Gay Harden.
Wait a minute, where are you going? Don't walk away from me. We're husband and wife. I want to have a baby, our baby. That's what the progression of things is about. That's what the union is about.
That's not what the union is about.
Well, what else is there?
That's not what it's about, Jack.
For me?
The vows don't stipulate baby. I am not going to bring another life into that. We are painters, Jackson. We don't have any money. We don't get by. We struggle. But you are a great artist. I believe in Jackson Pollock. And there's you, and there's the painting, and you need. And I don't want to be anywhere else. I don't want to be with anyone else. But that's all I can handle.
Curator Kirk Varnado wrote a catalog essay in which he got beneath the mythology that grew around Jackson Pollock. When I spoke with Varnado in 1998, I asked him to start with the mythology itself.
Jackson Pollock's life has a tremendous drama to it. He struggles very hard in lonely isolation, comes out of a poor, itinerant family in the West, moves to New York, and after 10 years of very lonely misery in the Depression years, breaks through in the early 40s and comes to very high degree of success in the late 40s, has an article in Life magazine, becomes the king of the hill. From out of nowhere, becomes the leading American painter of his generation, and then almost as precipitously falls into alcoholism, depression in the 50s, and then is killed in a car crash driving drunk in 1956. So it's a great American story of humble beginnings, giant success, tragic flaw, and violent death. It has all of the accoutrements of a great sort of mythic drama in the American popular culture sense. There are overtones in the image of Pollock that you see in those photographs in Life magazine in 1949, black denim, cigarette dangling off of his lips. There's a lot of Brando, there's a lot of James Dean, there's the whole sense of the rebel bohemian who pays the high price for his transgressions. All of this surrounds his artwork with an air of celebrity, stardom, and makes him the first of his kind, really, in the American visual arts, that later Warhol and others would become, and that is a kind of star artist. And I think the myths of him, the myths of Pollock, have to do with the strongly tragic inflection one reads into that life.
And part of that image, too, is that macho that he brought to his painting and to his public image.
When Pollock appeared in Life magazine in 1949, leaning against his own painting with his arms crossed, sort of sneering at the camera with the cigarette dangling off his lips, I think most Life readers would have thought that an abstract painter was some curiously effete European with a beret and strange aesthetic theories. And the idea of this sort of working class, tough guy, hard-drinking, bar-fighting image that Pollock projected was a complete revolution in consciousness about what modern art was for the American audience.
Let's look at his paintings and his actual approach to doing them, and then we'll get back to the story of his life and the story of his image. Pollock is most famous for splattering and dripping paint. He didn't like to use brushes. Would you describe his approach to painting during the most celebrated period of his career?
Yeah, beginning in 1947, Pollock took something that had been a marginal part of his own procedure as a painter and something that other painters had used in one form or another, and that is liquefied paint, poured, dripped, splattered, drizzled, there are a number of different words that you would use, onto the canvas, with the canvas laid out on the floor beneath him. He did this sometimes by punching a hole in a paint can and using that to draw with as the paint dripped down, by pouring paint down a stick, by using a dried brush that would throw out a fan of paint. In many different techniques with varying degrees of force and with varying degrees of subtlety and control, he built up these webs of liquefied line on the canvas. And it wasn't as if he was pouring paint in order to draw a tree or draw a face. The whole composition of the canvas was a series of webs of movement and line, of the splotches and splatters, the frittered away vectors of line as he moved across areas, the puddlings of paint as they marbled together. The process of his art is apparent in the finished artwork and determines a lot of the shape, the actual materials he uses, the way they fall, the way they react to each other, determine the quality of the line, so that instead of executing a preordained schema or following a prepared drawing, he spun out literally in a spontaneous fashion, like a jazz artist, his composition as he worked. And the end result has no horizon, no up, no down, no center or side in terms of standard compositions. It's instead a kind of cloud or pulsing web or a series of dendrites or synapses of linear energy. And that's all of these things were shocking. But I think the poured or dripped aspect suggested to many people a lack of control. It lacked the kind of touch or personality of an artist's brushwork. And it suggested an infatuation with chaos or accident.
Well, do you see Jackson Pollock's paintings as being involved with chance processes? Or do you think that finally there's a sense of order that he, as the painter, brings to the canvas?
The more I look at Pollock's canvases, the more I'm impressed with the sense of control that he had over what he did. He did like the sense of dynamism and spontaneity. He liked to see the effect of paint as it fell. And every time he would make a mark, he would then respond to that mark. So if there was an accident or an occurrence that he didn't like on the canvas, he would tend to paint over it. These pictures are generally done in layers, and each layer would respond to, adjust, correct, cover over the previous layer in selective fashion. He had the kind of control which is not planned. It's not like he's a strategic artist, but like a great athlete or like a ballet dancer, he had an amazing feel for the movement of his body in the air, for the medium that he was using, in which, though he was engaged in the act of painting and not reflecting on it, he still had a fine degree of control between the thick and the thin, the speed, the puddle, the splatter of the line that he was using. And if you look at the paintings, you'll see that the so-called drip method or pouring method is not one style, that he had to reinvent it on widely differing scales so that the same gestures he made in the compass of a wrist had to be reinvented to hold the sweep of an arm across a canvas 10 feet high. and lines that were 3 inches thick at some point had to be recalibrated in smaller works to be as fine as a hair. That there's this constant sense of reinvention and an enormous variety of expression in the work. So he was able to control not only the palette and the color, but the feeling that the work was aggressive or joyous, light and dancing, or nebular and lush. There's a broad range of effect in this work that suggests that he knew very strongly the character of each picture as he worked on it and pulled that character out.
Pollock liked to paint with the canvas on the floor, which is different from the perspective painters usually use till that point, which is on an easel or on the wall. What did it give him to be able to work on the floor?
You know, the first statement that he made about working on the floor when he talked about the way he liked to work, he talked about the resistance of pushing against a hard material. Instead of stretching a canvas taut on a standard stretcher the way a lot of artists do, he first worked with it nailed to the wall. He liked the resistance. He liked to push. And then when he got it on the floor, he not only got to push against something hard as he put the paint down on the canvas, he also got to work on it from all sides so that he could walk around it, work the top, work the bottom, work the sides, and somehow feel that he was inside the canvas. Inevitably, when you set something up on the wall, the connotation is like a window. It's something you're looking into in a frame. But when the work is down on the floor, it's a receiving ground. You have a different relationship with your body to the work that you're making. And I think that his sense of liking to be in the picture or over the picture, to feel the work falling down on it and the floorboards pushing back up, was something that got him into working on the floor. The remarkable thing is that during the great period of the poured and drip paintings, it was precisely that sense of resistance or friction that he seemed to like so much when he started working on hard surfaces that he gave up and internalized or sublimated into this choreography in the air just above the canvas that let the material fall. So there's a kind of muscular tension built into the way that he works, which is like a residue or a memory of his push against the hard surfaces of the floor and the wall in his early work.
So Pollock really works with gravity in some respects.
Very much so. And, you know, I think when Pollock's works were shown in 1967, they had the greatest impact on young sculptors, precisely because of the sense of gravity in his work. There were many people who felt that Pollock had, in a certain sense, pulled all the air out of the room for painters, that his statement was so extreme that there was no way to follow him without being merely an imitator. But for young sculptors in the late 60s, seeing the Pollock retrospective in the context of an era then dominated by hard-edged geometry and minimalism or the very sharp, bright colors of pop, young artists like Richard Serra or Eva Hesse or Robert Smithson felt that Pollock's work with gravity and his willingness to let materials have their own form, to respond to the dynamic of the tarriness and liquidity of black paint, to use silver paint, to let things fall, opened up a whole body of installation sculpture, people who worked with detritus flung down on the ground, Richard Serra's thrown lead pieces, Robert Smithson's poured asphalt pieces, the dialogue with the concrete materiality of property. For a lot of Pollock's contemporaries, it was the subjective spirit that seemed to be important. It was the psychological trauma that seemed to be inherent in his work. But for artists of the late 60s, it was the concrete materiality and specifically the relationship to gravity and weight that was so impressive.
What do you think Pollock's drip paintings represent in terms of a conceptual breakthrough in art?
Well, like many moments in modern art, Pollock's breakthrough in 1947-48 had a tremendous destructive force. It seemed to eliminate many things on which painting had traditionally depended. No standard composition, even cubism depended, not though it obviously rejected the idea of imitation of the natural world, it still depended on a compositional relationship of opposing masses. There was something in the picture about balance and construction and structure. Pollock seemed to void all of that, to get that out of there. He seemed to make the process almost take dominance over the product, and he seemed to give up on any notion of art fulfilling a plan. In fact, art seemed to be the result of a form of behavior in a way that opened up into happenings, into performance art. One of the things that's astonishing about Pollock and his legacy is that the breakthrough he made and the kind of art he made seem to feed or nurture artists who produced work radically different in appearance from his own work. So Pollock's breakthrough was to give a new sense of permission to a lot of different artists.
My guest is Kirk Varnadeau, chief curator of the Painting and Sculpture Department at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ed Harris is starring in a new movie about Jackson Pollock. Let's get back to our interview about Pollock's life and work with Kirk Varnadeau, who curated a 1998 Pollock retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York and wrote a catalog essay. I found it very interesting in reading the essay that, until Pollock started experimenting with the techniques that he originated, he thought of his art as kind of derivative and unremarkable, and other people thought of it that way as well.
Yeah, Pollock was no Mozart. I mean, it's really unusual. He had a fixation from very early on as a teenager that he wanted to be an artist. I think his older brother, Charles, who was about 8 years old, 8 years older, had pursued a career in art. And I think that Pollock, watching him leave home and establishing himself outside, got the idea that this was a way to get out of his circumstances, and this was something he could be that would be different from what he had been as a child. But he had no talent for it whatsoever. Charles had a certain amount of talent. The brother closest to Jackson in age, Sandy, also pursued a career in art. He was recognized as having a certain kind of talent. Everybody looked at Pollock and his brother's description. If you'd seen those drawings, you would have advised him to become a tennis player or a plumber. He just really was struggling. And when he went to New York to study with Thomas Hart Benton, he was one of the least facile of the draftsmen in Benton's classes, the most struggling, the toughest in drawing. And he worked very, very hard, labored at it. But somewhere this driving ambition to become an artist in the late 30s forced Pollock face to face with Picasso. He just was determined that he was going to beat the greatest artist in the world at his own game, and in order to do that, he had to kind of swallow Picasso whole, so that when he saw Picasso's Guernica in New York and when he saw the great Picasso retrospective at the Modern in 1939, he completely absorbed, plunged himself into Picasso's symbolism, and picking up pieces from other artists as well, he began to hammer together the style. And when he first started showing in 1942-43, the critics who walked into the show said, oh yeah, I see, there's this much Picasso, there's this much Beckman, there's a little Kandinsky, there's this much Miro. All the sources were evident, and yet, they all looked at the painting and said, ooh, but yes, but this guy is original. This was a force, and I think you feel it when you get those pictures grouped together again, that the way he put the paint on canvas, and in fact, the very force of the struggle with the masters he was trying to come to terms with, is evident in the pictures and gives them a kind of special authenticity.
His breakthrough painting, I think, was the 1943 mural that he did for Peggy Guggenheim, the art collector and gallery owner and an heiress, I suppose. What was the commission that she presented to him?
Well, Peggy Guggenheim had just opened a new gallery called Art of This Century. She'd moved to the U.S. from Europe in light of the war, and she brought with her a great collection of avant-garde art. And she had the idea that she was going to mix her collection of European modernists with showing younger American artists. And so she had advisors among curators in New York, and they spotted Pollock as a talent. She signed Pollock to a contract, and she scheduled him for a first monographic show in 1943. And in that summer, in preparation for the show, she commissioned Pollock to paint a big mural for the foyer of her apartment on the Upper East Side. And Marcel Duchamp, who was very canny, said, don't let him do it on the wall because you may move. have him painted on canvas. So she commissioned an 18-foot-long canvas for and about 9 or 10 feet high for the foyer of her apartment, in principle to be finished in time for the show in November. And Pollock didn't even have a room big enough to paint an 18-foot-long canvas, so he and his wife, Lee, surreptitiously tore down a wall in their apartment and took the drywall out in buckets at night so the landlord wouldn't know what they were doing, so they could open up a wall between two rooms large enough to stretch this canvas. And the accounts that we have suggest that the canvas stayed there bare all during the summer. Pollock was working like a demon in August, producing many of the more moderate-sized pictures that went into the show in 43. But apparently, by the time of November and the time of the exhibition, the big mural was still unfinished. And there are even witness accounts of people who went to dinner with Pollock just before Christmas who claimed that there was absolutely nothing on the canvas. And the story goes that Peggy Guggenheim was having a party somewhere in mid-January and said, okay, either that mural is on my wall or you are history, get that thing done. And according to Lee Krasner, Pollock then sort of locks himself in the room and in one night and day, in about a 15-hour session, rips this thing off. It's a real sort of Paul Bunyan exploit story, and it sparks a certain amount of cynicism. And yet, when you look at the picture, there's clearly nothing labored or premeditated about the picture. It has an enormous surge. It's basically a kind of frieze of turbulent stick figure type vectors that stampede across these 18 feet of the canvas, and it's done with tremendous brio. There's very little second thinking about it. There's no composition under it, and it seems to have been done, if not exactly in those circumstances, certainly in an all-out blitz of work, of a tremendous spontaneity that seems to untie every knot that's constricted together in all the rest of Pollock's work at the time. It makes the rest of Pollock's work at the time look comparatively stiff and packed and forced, whereas this thing just lets loose a fantastic cavalcade of energy in a way that's very premonitory of the large later drip paintings.
But he's not dripping yet.
No, this is all done with a brush.
We'll hear more of our interview with Museum of Modern Art curator Kirk Varnado in the second half of the show. Ed Harris's new movie, Pollock, opened today in New York and Los Angeles and opens nationally in February. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, working for 50 years to enhance the quality of life in communities and to support a free press. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the life and work of Jackson Pollock. Also, we remember actor Werner Klemperer, who played Colonel Klink on Hogan's Heroes. He died last week. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new animated comedy, The Emperor's New Groove.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ed Harris is starring in a new movie about the life of artist Jackson Pollock. Let's get back to our interview about Pollock's life and work with Kirk Varnado. He was the lead curator of the 1998 Jackson Pollock retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He also wrote an essay in the catalog published by the museum. When we left off, we were talking about Pollock's breakthrough painting, a mural commissioned in 1944 by Peggy Guggenheim for the hallway of her townhouse. So he does this mural for Peggy Guggenheim. A couple of years later, moves to East Hampton, Long Island, which is a beautiful, kind of rural area, and the outer part of Long Island. Why did he and his wife Lee Krasner move from Manhattan?
Well, Lee Krasner was 4 years older than Jackson, and she had met him around 1942, and she saw that he had a lot of troubles, and that those troubles were closely tied up with alcohol. And I think that she certainly had a strong vision of his potential as an artist. She was very convinced that he was a great talent. And they had gone out for the summer to visit friends in the Hamptons, and she saw that he was much more at ease in nature and that being away from the city did him a lot of good. So it's a very strong idea that if they moved there, he'd be able to concentrate on his art better and their life would be simpler because he would be away from his cronies in the city and away from the bars. So she put down the ultimatum that they get married because she, for one thing, didn't think that outside the city, cohabitation without marriage would be so favorably looked on by the villagers around East Hampton. And they bought a small 19th century farmhouse with a little barn right on in this area called the Springs in the East Hampton village. And they had no automobile. They had a bicycle, and they walked for the first couple of years they were out there. And this was not the Hamptons of today. This was truly isolated. It was a long way out. And Pollock had now contact with the ocean. He said that he thought the vast span of the Atlantic Ocean was the only East Coast equivalent for the spaces that he'd grown up with as a child in the West. And you see right away that the two series that he painted in 1946, the first year that he's really fully painting out there, are titled the Akabonic Creek series, which is right after the small stream that runs by their property, and the other one was called the Sounds in the Grass series. And both of them are evocative of his new closeness to nature. So it's the distance from the bars, in some sense, and the closeness to nature on the other, and just the sheer isolation and focus, which I think had a crucial role in promoting the advance of Pollock's art in that period.
He set up his studio in a little barn, which you describe as really being more the size of a tool shed. You've been in that barn. What was it like to be in there, and what was surprising about the experience of being inside it?
I really thought that one of the cores of my experience in doing the show and my feeling about Pollock was the moment when I stepped up, and you actually, it's almost like going onto a stage because he moved this little barn and put in a new floor. So you actually step up a foot or so onto the floor that he painted on. And the floor is still the same. When Pollock got a little money at the end of his life, he put insulation on this barn and white wallboard, and then Lee Krasner used it as a studio and put up lights. But you have to imagine it as it was when Pollock first worked in it. Bare boards, the wind whistled through, you could see through the boards to the outside. He had no electricity in it. He could only paint in the daytime, and he could really only paint in good weather. He couldn't use it all winter. The astonishing thing about the space, however, is how incredibly small it is. If you're used to the large paintings that we see regularly in New York, the big one, number 31, 1950, that the Museum of Modern Art owns, or Autumn Rhythm, which the Metropolitan owns, these things are colossal, and they seem to have a vast, expansive space, and you suddenly find yourself in this closet. And the feeling first is, no, I just don't believe it. These canvases couldn't fit. And then you take the tape measure out, and you see that, indeed, when he put them on the floor, they nearly touched both walls and left him only a narrow zone to work in. And after you accept that physically they fit, then you have to come to terms with how it is possible to imagine the spaces that are in those paintings when you are physically in such a restricted and small space. We have a lot of photographs of Pollock working in this space, and they're taken by Hans Namath, the photographer of Pollock at work. And Namath would often get himself up into the rafters to take pictures of Pollock, looking down at Pollock working on the canvases. And the photographs are very deceptive. They would lead you to believe the space is like a New York loft. Not at all. It's like a tiny New York closet in a way, and it's truly striking to stand there and see how little distance Pollock could get from these works. We're used to standing back 15, 20 feet, you know, and then moving back further. This was a 21-foot square, this little room, and its sides were stacked up with the canvases that he had already completed. So he had even less working room, and all the pictures he had already made pressed in from all sides around him. It's an astonishing readjustment of the mind to stand in that space. And for that very reason, in the exhibition at the Modern, we have recreated to exact scale and with old barn board the studio so that the visitors to the exhibition can get precisely that shock of disjunction between the material circumstances and the results.
You write that Pollock had one great overpowering idea. It came to him at the end of 1946, produced some of the most inexhaustible artworks of the century over almost 4 years, and then was over as abruptly as it had begun. What happened? Was he blocked? Was he tired of the style he had created?
The million-dollar question, in a certain sense, is why he stopped. There are many contingent factors. Pollock, who had a problem with alcoholism throughout his life, was in fact sober from 48 to 50, partly because of a doctor who prescribed tranquilizers for him and who he trusted. And the doctor was killed in a car crash in the spring of 50. So when the great tension came for Pollock's largest show of drip paintings in the fall of 50, he had no fallback position. He started drinking again very strongly. The show didn't sell. He got profoundly depressed and started drinking more, and things began spiraling down. What's clear is that he was unwilling to repeat himself, that having risen to a certain summit on this motif and this way of painting, that though they were still in demand, he was unwilling to go back. He wanted to find some new way, and he simply never found himself again as strongly.
Now, the problems that he had with depression and alcoholism, those were problems that originated when he was much younger.
He started drinking when he was 15, and it's clear that he had no tolerance for it, that he was very weak for it, and he clearly had emotional disturbances. He was a pugnacious youth. He slugged a couple of instructors in grade school and high school. He was thrown out of high school a couple of times. He clearly had a real problem with authority and discipline. Even though he sought out father-like mentors in Benton and Graham and the other instructors that he had in art, he had a real social problem, and he had a drinking problem, and the two of them linked together. And it's very hard now to know psychoanalytically what the roots of these issues were for him.
Describe how Pollock died.
Pollock, at the end of his life, had been drinking a great, great deal. He had split up with his wife, more or less, Lee Krasner. They were in very bad terms. Lee had gone to Europe in the summer of 56, and a girlfriend that Pollock had met in a bar in New York came out to the Hamptons to visit on Saturday, August 11th, 1956, and she brought a friend of hers with her. Pollock drank all afternoon, and they started driving at night. They were driving towards Pollock's house, and Pollock was driving too fast. The friend of the girlfriend started shrieking, "Let me out of the car." That goaded Pollock to drive faster. He flipped his Oldsmobile convertible, and his girlfriend survived, but her friend was crushed beneath the car, and Pollock was thrown out of the car and hit a tree and died instantly.
How do you think his early death affected his reputation and his legend?
I think that the market for New York art was poised to accelerate anyway. The late 50s were a period of time for enormous expansion for American culture and the world in general, and prices started going up sharply. But Pollock's death and the rarity that introduced into his work obviously boosted his prices enormously as this general wave happened in the late 50s. And I think that it's clear that he was not headed in a good direction when he died, and the fact that the life was snuffed out and stopped short gave it a kind of tragic wholeness that made it mythic in the eyes and in the minds of many people, confirmed his role in the popular imagination as a tragic rebel, and that can't have hurt. On the other hand, I think it was great art. It always was great art that he produced. It's proved to be, over the years, fabulous and terrific art. And the art transcends whatever myth surrounds it, I believe.
Now, you spoke a little bit earlier about how you think Pollock's paintings influenced other painters and other sculptors. I'm wondering about how you think his life influenced younger artists who are always trying to live up to their role models and copy them.
You know, I think Pollock's life is one of those things that people like to dream about but not imitate. Almost immediately after Pollock died in the late 1950s and early 1960s, you got the model of Jasper Johns or then Andy Warhol, much more detached from the work. Warhol's model of an artist building a career in a certain sense, living in the city, being hip, being urban, being ironic, being detached, the sense of burning yourself up for your art, which was a kind of ideal of Pollock's generation, a beat generation idea of authenticity gained by spurning the world and plunging into the work. That's not an ideal that was very attractive to artists in the 60s who wanted something a little more distant, a little more cerebral, or more ironic. And I think that the sort of romanticized Pollock, the bohemian tragic Pollock, has not been the kind of thing very many artists have been willing to model their actual working life after.
Now, how do you think critical evaluations of him have changed over the years?
I think in the 1950s, and even afterwards, one tended to look at Pollock's art as a kind of direct extension of his life, that you had a turbulent turmoil of a life that realized itself in an angst-filled, storm-tossed set of pictures. And yet now when we look back at these pictures, we see that there are elements of real lyricism and beautiful, delicate, decorative properties in these pictures that are absolutely the opposite of the macho bar fighter that everybody presumed earlier. Similarly, I think people looked at the pictures earlier as the representation of the kind of fragmentation of the atomic age, of a kind of alienation or apocalyptic energy, whereas now one can see them as suffused with a kind of romanticism. I think that over the years we've become to deal more with the pictures themselves as a life lived on canvas, independent of or separate from the life that the man lived, and related to its time, but also larger than that. And we're still in the process of understanding these pictures.
Kirk Varnadoe is chief curator of painting and sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. We spoke in 1998 when Varnadoe organized a retrospective of Jackson Pollock's work. A new movie about Pollock, starring Ed Harris, opened today in New York and Los Angeles and opens nationally in February. Coming up, we remember Werner Klemperer, who played Colonel Klink on Hogan's Heroes. He died last week. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember actor Werner Klemperer. He died last week at the age of 80. Klemperer starred in Hogan's Heroes, the World War II sitcom set at a German prisoner of war camp. Klemperer played the incompetent camp commander, Colonel Klink. He was nominated for an Emmy during each year of the series' run from 1965 to 71. He won two Emmys. He was born in Germany in 1920, fled the Nazis with his family in 1933, and eventually settled in Los Angeles. Klemperer's father was the famous conductor Otto Klemperer, who was Jewish. I spoke with Werner Klemperer in 1987 when he was starring with Joel Grey in a revival of Cabaret set in Berlin during the rise of the Nazis. Klemperer played the Jewish shopkeeper Herr Schultz. I asked him if audiences who knew him as Colonel Klink would be surprised by his performance in Cabaret.
Well, I think I certainly am showing a different side of me as opposed to Colonel Klink in Hogan's Heroes, and in some ways a different side of me with some of the rather harsh and villainous parts I've played. But I don't think it's something that's that foreign to me. It's a great joy to do it because the part is truly sympathetic, and an actor always loves to do that. And also I had a chance to sing, which is not my specialty, although I've done a little of it, and for me to have an opportunity to work on Broadway also singing meant something to me.
I really enjoyed your singing very much, and you seem to really sing from the heart. And I also—
That's so nice of you to say, because I have great, I don't feel very secure about that part of my work, because that's not, you know, what I've done so much, and I'm glad to hear somebody tells me it was good.
You lived in Germany during the period that Cabaret is set. and your family fled Germany after Hitler was elected chancellor. Is this a very personal role for you?
I give you one example, and that might make it clear to you. In this show, as you remember, in the last scene that I'm involved in, when I say goodbye to the younger couple and tell them that I am moving from one apartment to another to be further away from Fräulein Schneider, the woman that has decided not to marry me, I mention the name of a place, a square in Berlin, where this apartment is that I'm going to. Well, I hate to tell you this, but it's the truth. Our family lived 200 yards away from that place. And every time I have to say that name of that place, I have shivers up and down my spine because I had to go through that square to go to school every morning. I went to grammar school at that time. So that brings everything very much into focus for me.
Do you have memories of Hitler coming to power? Do you
Yes, I have memories as a child about the excitement of the city, about some of the young SA men running around the street, throwing bricks into Jewish stores and creating turmoil everywhere, and the police having fights with them, and that sort of thing. I have those kind of images, but nothing more than that, really.
So you were really very young when your family fled the country, and you couldn't really understand the political ramifications and the
religious ramifications of what was happening to some degree, because my father and mother made sure that we children were kept somewhat knowledgeable about what was happening, but I didn't really realize the heaviness of the situation. The interesting part is, you know, that many of our friends and acquaintances, many of the Jewish faith, didn't think, as many German Jews did not think, that this was going to last, this was going to be a passing phase, as the character that I play says. And they just sort of put blinders on and said, this is ridiculous, there'll be another regime soon and everything will be fine and I must stay with my country. And that, of course, the rest is history.
So you and your family moved to Los Angeles.
Well, eventually. We were in Vienna, Austria for a couple of years, but then we moved to Los Angeles because my dad was offered the post of the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
I'm listening to your voice, and you don't really sound like you have much of a German accent. I guess you move
well,
young enough to...
Well, I work... It depends on how I concentrate. Now, I'm not... I'm reasonably relaxed with you, and I am trying to just speak as straight as I can. There are times when it creeps in more. There are other times when I can lose it completely if I really have to force myself.
For a man with a German accent, were your roles at the beginning of your career
stereotyped?
Stereotyped,
but
yeah.
Then it changed. And also you have to remember, if you... In this business, particularly in the motion picture and film industry, if you have an accent, they give you foreign roles, not necessarily of one country, and you just change a little bit, change the accent a little bit so I could play. I've played Frenchmen, I played villains in almost any country you want to think of. You know, before Hogan's Heroes, I used to be a heavy in television. Nobody knew my name, but I played heavies all over the place.
When you were first offered the role of Colonel Klink in Hogan's Heroes, what did you think of this idea for a TV series?
Well,
like a sitcom
the
about
reason,
a German
No, 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 let me explain
camp.
To you. When I was offered this role, I wasn't offered it in the first place. I was just called to meet with a producer, and my agent, I'll never forget this if I live to be 1,000 years old, called me up and said, "You, I have an interview for you for a half-hour show in which they are looking for the commandant of a POW camp in World War II. I said, "Fine." That's all he said. He never mentioned comedy. And I'd been playing some of those kind of roles straight and serious. So I went to the interview, met the producer, sat down and talked to him, and he said, "You know, this is a comedy." And I thought for a minute the guy was, you know, kidding me. And then he shoved some pieces of paper in front of me that was a couple of scenes that had been written already for the pilot. I looked at it, and it began to look quite clever, and I began to be more interested. The material was very persuasive because it was very cleverly done, and it was very satirical, and it appealed to me. I made one, when they offered me the role, I made one stipulation to the producer. I said, if in any of the segments the character of Colonel Klink wins out in the end, I will not be with this show anymore. And that was the end of that. Well, he never won out anyway. That wasn't written that way.
Werner Klemperer, recorded in 1987. He died last week at the age of 80. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new animated film, The Emperor's New Groove. This is Fresh Air. The Emperor's New Groove is a new animated comedy from Disney. It features the voices of David Spade, Eartha Kitt, and John Goodman. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
For an industry that prides itself on providing light entertainment, modern Hollywood certainly does a crummy job producing it. Hardly a comedy comes by that doesn't spend most of its time poking the audience in the ribs, asking the nagging question, "Are we having fun yet?" Disney's animated feature, The Emperor's New Groove, is a happy exception. This story of an obnoxious young Incan emperor who is magically transformed into a llama sets out with a sly winking tone and hikes its way to belly laugh territory. It takes the potentially off-putting sarcastic humor of David Spade, who provides the emperor's voice, and makes it into something more than the defensive vitriol of a weakling. Emperor Cuzco is so focused on himself that he doesn't even notice when the people he's needling turn him into a four-footed beast. This transformation occurs in his luxurious palace, in the quarters of his former advisor, the aged Yzma, who is voiced by the vocally awesome Eartha Kitt. Cuzco has fired Yzma, and she, along with her dumb but loyal hunk of a bodyguard, Kronk, has decided to poison the emperor at an intimate farewell dinner.
A toast to the emperor. Long live Cuzco!
Don't drink the water.
Tasty.
Finally! Good work, Kronk.
Oh, they're so easy to make. I'll get you the recipe.
Now, to get rid of the body.
Okay, what were we saying?
We were just making a toast to your long and healthy rule.
Right. So, what are you gonna do? I mean, you've been around here a long time, and I really mean a long time. I mean, it might be difficult for someone of your age adjusting to life in the private sector. Hey, Kronk, can you top me off, pal? Be a friend?
As you can hear, the movie thrives on chaos. The animators have also brewed up an eclectic mixture of animation styles. On one level, The Emperor's New Groove is a typical Disney film. The Emperor's Palace is huge and labyrinthine in the interiors and looming in its exterior. And when Cuzco lands in the middle of a pack of hungry jaguars, the ensuing action with its flashing blacks and reds is yet another manifestation of the studio's brilliance with color. The dialogue is also familiar from contemporary Disney films. It's all wisecracks, heavy on the anachronisms, and spun by Spade's brand of caustic humor. This works often, but not always, and if the movie has a weakness, it's in the relentlessly show-busy chatter. But if the backdrops, color, and talk are pure Disney, the characters and the action are inspired by a wholly unexpected quarter, the Warner Brothers animation style, and in particular the work of Chuck Jones. Even unpracticed eyes can see Jones's influence. Yzma, for example, looks like the older sister of the Grinch from Jones's classic holiday animation. In typical Jones style, Yzma is a victim of her own personality. She'd like to be evil, but she doesn't quite have the chops or the shape for it. She cradles her cocked head in a hand of long, bony fingers, casts her eyes heavenward in thought, and comes up with a complicated plan. But those plans turn out to be so complicated that the Roadrunner, Kuzco, gets away time and again. Kronk, the hunk of naive muscle who gets his voice from Patrick Warburton, is the funniest character in the movie and another example of the Jones influence. In his Warner days, Jones used to create some dog characters with bulky torsos and tiny legs. Their personalities matched their physiology, large masses of potential violence which were supported by dainty affections. Kronk is exactly the same shape, and though he's the biggest, strongest character in the movie, he never once uses that strength against another person. And when he moves, he doesn't stride, but almost tiptoes, even if it's tiptoeing with jackhammer speed. Director Mark Dindal blends the disparate styles into a seamless, cohesive whole that never draws attention to itself. That's the mark of real entertainers. They only want the act and never the sweat to show. But that doesn't mean they aren't clever, and it doesn't mean they haven't sweated the details. We can take The Emperor's New Groove lightly because Dindal and company took it so much to heart.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Schirach. Our engineer was Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Now what will Santa Claus say when he finds everybody swinging? What will Santa Claus say when he hears us sing, sing, singing? Down the chimney he will come with his great big smile, and he'll find that even the kiddies are swinging in a latest style.
Oh, oh, oh,
what is Santa bringing?
Oh, oh, oh,
I wonder whether he'll be swinging everywhere in the land. All the people will be singing
la-di-da-di-da.
Now what is Santa Claus gonna say when he finds everybody swinging? Oh, what will Santa Claus say when he finds everybody swinging? What will Santa Claus say when he hears us sing, sing, singing? Down the chimney he will come, he will come. Da 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 da. What is Santa bringing?
Oh, oh, oh,
I wonder whether he'll be...
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Nonesuch Records, featuring Red Dirt Girl, the new album by Emmylou Harris, available in record stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Christine Baranski. She's starring in the new sitcom Welcome to New York. In the sitcom Sybil, she starred as Sybil's best friend. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.